Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Jim Walton from The Third Choice, a ministry designed for dialogue and training, where we seek truth with no judgment, no jamming anything down anybody's throat, but lots of good information and answers you can trust. With each episode, I tackle a question of the day with the hope of both informing and stimulating thought and further questions. We want people to think. We want people to ask and to learn. Hi, this is Jim Walton from The Third Choice. I have with me today David Gibson. It's so good to be talking to you. David worked in the Vatican. He's worked with the Pope. And we have just a whole bunch of questions for David today. And I appreciate you being on with me. David, why don't you tell us when you worked at the Vatican, what your job was, and what popes you were there. You know, just give us a little bit of background here, okay?
Yeah, well, thanks, Jim, and it's good to be with you. I we said worked in the Vatican, worked with the Pope. Now it's which Pope? it's kind of a long story, but I raised in New Jersey and raised as an evangelical Plymouth Brethren. But I wound up traveling after college in Europe and wound up getting a job in Rome, first teaching English in the late 1980s. And then I got a job at an English language newspaper, just kind of fell into that. I'd never done journalism before. But as I tell journalism students when I talk to them, if you're ever really struggling, you don't know, you don't have a job, you don't know what you're going to do with your career, just buy a one-way ticket to a foreign capital. Because the talent pool for English-speaking people, journalists, teachers, is so shallow that you'll automatically, it's easy to get a job. I was able to get jobs with virtually no talent. And so I got this job in an English language newspaper, which catered to the expatriate community there. And then I got a job at Vatican Radio, which is kind of, I call it the cross between armed forces radio for the Pope and NPR. And it's kind of like the public radio for the Catholic Church, and has programs in 35 different languages, or did until a few years ago when they started having to cut down on some of them, but went out on shortwave, et cetera. And I got a job with the English program. And even though I came from New Jersey and I sounded like it, and I'd never done radio before, and they said, don't worry, you'll learn. And I did. I love radio. It was my real entree into journalism, and it's a great medium. And I wound up staying. I went for a few months to live in Rome because I studied European history and I loved it. Here I was, an evangelical Protestant working for Vatican Radio, but they were very broad-minded that way at the Vatican. And I stayed for 5 years. And then when I came back to the States, back to New Jersey and New York area, I got a job at various newspapers and eventually pivoted into doing some freelance, doing a magazine, doing a couple books. And I always covered religion of all kinds, but a real focus on the Catholic Church. When you say worked for popes, it was John Paul II back then, the Polish.
Okay, yeah. Pope. What years were you there, the 5 years you were there?
Yeah, 1985 to 90. And I get back, every couple of years at least to do reporting and various writing. So I'm back there pretty regularly. But John Paul II, it's hard to, realize for so many, who helped bring down Soviet communism, did so many things kind of on the geopolitical stage. And everybody thought, he was Pope for 26 years, which was one of the longest papacies in 2000 years. And everybody thought he was the Pope. And then you had Benedict XVI, who retired, first Pope in 700 years to retire. Usually you die with your boots on. And then now we have Pope Francis, who's been remarkable. But I myself, I'm also, I should say, just 2-3 years ago, came to Fordham University. So I left daily journalism. I still write periodically and about religious issues in the United States. But I'm at Fordham University, and I run a center there, the Center on Religion and Culture. And Fordham is the Jesuit university. Jesuits, a big, large order, in very focused on education, large Catholic order. And Fordham University has campuses in Manhattan and in the Bronx. So that's kind of a new career turn for me, but also really in a similar kind of vein, putting on conversations, usually public conversations like we're having on various topics, religion and culture, which, as you know, means anything you want it to mean, from politics to movies, but, you know, conversations. But increasingly, because of the pandemic, obviously, we've had to do a lot of virtual events like we're doing now, and which may have to be the future for the next 6 months or a year.
Now, you said you worked with John Paul, but I've seen pictures of you with Pope Francis. So you've been at the Vatican with Pope Francis.
I've been there a couple. Yeah, been there when he's been there. I've got a great life-size cutout with the Pope, which works really well. I actually have it. It's a stand sitting outside my office door, and people love walking. I need something to sort of draw people back to my office, you know.
Yeah.
And they love taking pictures with it, and I insist they give me $1 for each one, but I never follow through on it. But yeah, I was there when he was elected in March for the conclave, March 2013. And for, you know, the first initial weeks after he was there, and I've gone back several times to report. I was supposed to go back in March of this year, but a little thing called COVID-19 interrupted all of our plans.
Plans. Yeah. Okay, well, I wanted to talk to you today about the conspiracy theories. I mentioned that to you, that there are so many flying around about the Pope and the Vatican and the papacy. And so if we could just launch right in, David, and hear what you've got to say. So I'll just plunge in and start right away. This spring, this very spring in 2020, there were rumors circulating on social media that Pope Francis had died and that the Vatican was covering it up. So I guess my first question is Pope Francis actually still alive?
He is.
He is.
Actually, yes, he is. And he's, you know, it's, I mean, it's amazing what's out there on social media. And the whole, this whole issue of conspiracies, and particularly conspiracies in Christians, I think is a very worrying thing. And I think, you know, it's a problem that we can all succumb to, and especially in the age of social media and unverified reports that can be out there. But he, you know, he, I guess part of that is because when the pandemic forced a lockdown, and he couldn't, you know, he does things every day.
Yeah,
With crowds and with people and the whole thing. And he couldn't suddenly. But one thing they did start doing was, you know, he celebrates Mass every morning in his private chapel there. He lives in the Vatican. One of the big things he did was leave the Apostolic Palace, as we call it, the great ornate, you know, palace in the Vatican, and just decide to stay in the kind of Vatican guest house, which is basically a glorified Motel 6. And perfectly fine accommodations for him. He's a Jesuit, very simple living person. And there's a chapel there, and he always celebrates Mass every morning for just small guests who are in the guest house, et cetera. But they started televising those during the lockdown every morning, which is very nice. And that was kind of proof of life, as what they would say in the hostage taking business. Right. So no, he's alive and kicking, but you know, there's always, he's also 83, and as you and I get older, you know, you want to think that's not that old, but hey, sorry, you know, it is. It's one of these things. Any of us can die any day. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, when he was talking about his election, you know, Pope Benedict had retired. He was 86 or something and frail and just didn't have the strength. And he said, I can't do this job anymore, which I really thought was a wonderful decision. You know, the papacy, you're not, you know, it's a job in many ways. It's a ministry. And when you can't do that ministry anymore, you can step aside. It doesn't mean you're any less a Christian or whatever, but a pastor. But they said, oh, we can't have anybody over 70, you know, because we need somebody younger and vigorous to do this job. Like John Paul II, who was the Polish Pope, elected when he was 58 years old, a skier and the whole thing. So what they do, they went and elected Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina, who is 76 years old. So, and he's been there for 8 years. So he's doing amazingly well health-wise. But at the same time, you know, when you're a controversial person, when you've got a lot of enemies out there, and when you're 83, there are always going to be rumors about your health. And, right. You know, those who want to cause trouble or also get people thinking about the next pope and who they would like to have in there.
Right. All right. My next question for you is the Pope an advocate for one world government? I've come across articles from June 2017 that he's calling for a global political authority, from May 2019 that he gave before the members of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences demanding a supranational legal constituted body of one world government. Can you comment about the Pope's desires or drive for a sort of a new world order, a one world government?
It's not really what he wants to institute. It's not something he's pushing for. What that phrase comes from actually is Pope Benedict, of all people, who's associated with being more conservative, has talked about that in terms of the United Nations and having more of a cooperative, internationally cooperative type, not a one world government, not some kind of, you know, Pope or somebody, you know, running everything at all, but a much more collaborative and cooperative international community, which a lot of people, especially in America, may not like the idea of that. I mean, so many people don't like the way the UN is run or even the idea of the United Nations. But the Vatican and the Catholic Church and Catholic teaching is much more open to and promotional of a global community, both politically and socially and in so many ways. So there's some of that language, I think, that can trigger that kind of one world government, supranational kind of thing. And they do very much promote the idea of supranational, international bodies to reflect on things like climate change. Not something that's going to issue dictates like in the European Union for everybody, but really something that would address global concerns in a global way. And so obviously that's going to generate differences of opinion for sure.
More like cooperation, international cooperation, rather than international authoritarianism, sort of.
Exactly. But again, there are those who would, you know, you can certainly disagree with that. Again, this gets to the point. I think there's certainly plenty you can disagree with, either the Pope, the Catholic Church, the Vatican, whatever, without it having to be a conspiracy theory. I think getting to your point, there's so many of these distinctions. And I think people, you know, they reject something, which is fine. You can disagree. You and I can disagree with something, but there's an impulse that we have to back up our disagreement with some evil intent of something that we create behind mm-hmm. that.
You satanize the opposition.
Exactly.
Demonize. Yeah.
Demonize. That's a good way to put it. And I think that's the problem. You know, that's a real concern that No, you don't have to. Someone can be wrong without them being satanic. You know, it's right. Simply wrong.
Well, what about the whole idea of one world religion? You know, in February of 2019, it said he signed the Abu Dhabi document of religious unity with the Muslims. And that has a lot of Christians on edge, that he's signed some kind of a joint statement with the Grand Imam, asserting that God wills a plurality of religions, and that is of concern to many Christian bodies. These looking for a plurality of religious expression. What's your comment about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, which is, it was this declaration on human fraternity. And again, it was a gesture of goodwill and a commitment to broad cooperation and tolerance of and cooperation with other religions. And certainly, especially since the Second Vatican Council of the 1960s, the Catholic Church has been deeply committed not just to ecumenism, which is cooperation, dialogue, and unity within the Christian world, but also inter-religious dialogue, which is dialogue with other religions, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, down the line.
So you think it's interreligious dialogue, not interreligious ecumenical unity?
No, and it's a funny thing because some people see it as, oh, they want to create one world religion, and at the same time they're upset with the Pope saying that God has willed a plurality of religions. So it's those are two kind of conflicting views, and you can disagree with both. The Pope is not going for one, you know, world religion. I mean, he's a Christian and he believes in in Jesus and just that's his entire identity and being, whether or not you're Catholic and whether or not you agree with Catholicism. What he does want is greater cooperation, and he does believe everyone is a child of God. And along with the Catholic Church, again, you see these different, even within the Christian world, you see these different churches and these different Christians, and they would say, the Catholic Church would say, these are not, you know, it's not just Catholics who are going to heaven and everyone else is condemned. And you can say that for other religions as well. One doesn't know, if one declares himself a Christian, whether they're saved or not, because you can declare things with your mouth and do things with, you know, in your life that are completely contrary to that. So it's, it's got a lot of different levels to that, but it's certainly, this is the reality of what we have out there with all of these different religions, and God is at work in the world. And so how do we view that?
Yeah, there's this logo here circulating around the internet, you know, showing the Muslim crescent with the Christian cross, the Morocco 2019, that again, that people say, you know, that shows that Francis wants a one world religion and just sort of tear down all the barriers and disregard theology and just become a one world religion. See, so that's where stuff like that comes from. It feeds the conspiracy theory.
And again, you don't have to agree with his outreach to Islam or the Catholic Church's outreach to other religions. That can be controversial, but yeah, the idea that he would be head of one world religion, he can barely be head of the Catholic Church. I mean, if you look at within our own church, there's so much disagreement and discord and, opposition there. He's lucky if he can be Pope of the Catholic Church, much less be head of some one world religion.
Yeah, there is. It is said that he is part of a cabal of world leaders. Whatever there are, 130 world leaders or whatever it is, again, with the intent to form a one world government. And they even look at some of the architecture, the obelisk that's in the Vatican, the obelisk that's in Washington, D.C., the obelisk that's in London, the UN logo copying the logo of the Roman Empire. And, you know, they talk about so that the Pope is part of this secret cabal that's trying to rise in power to run the world.
And it's interesting that, you know, so many of those things like the obelisk and so many of those symbols, like from the treasure hunter movies, Nicolas Cage and the treasure. Yeah. There were kind of these Da Vinci Code style things, mm-hmm. but those symbols are all from associated with masonry, you know, Freemasonry.
Right.
And which is, if you had any idea how Catholic leaders are opposed to Freemasonry, you know, the idea that they would be in league with some kind of secret society like that is kind of silly. That's the kind of thing that they denounce all of the time.
So Francis is not a Freemason?
Nope, not at all. Although you'll get some fringe Catholics who will assert that he's being good to Masons, even though he denounces them periodically, which always makes me laugh because I think of Freemasons in the United States is a very just friendly group who don't have any particular agenda, hidden or otherwise.
Yeah. Okay. Now on to something else. In very recent news, you know, it is said that he renounced his title as Vicar of Christ in the Vatican Pontifical Yearbook, and that he no longer regards himself as a guardian of the church. They say it's a fulfillment of a John 5:43 prophecy, and that he has renounced his title as vicar. What has he done that, and what's behind that?
Well, if he has, I think Protestants would be happier than anything. I think that's a title that always gives everyone pause. And it's actually a later kind of accretion, actually. But he didn't. That was again, that's another one of these things that kind of generates. It's just there's a big, thick red book of titles of everybody works in the Vatican, et cetera. And they just, for typesetting reasons, they kind of, that title is still in there. They just put it on a different page.
And so again, he didn't renounce the title.
No, he did not renounce the title. And I mean, there are some titles he probably should renounce, but I mean, there is a whole, yeah. And again, so he did not.
Okay.
But the fact that this starts, you know, is kind of unsettling. But it is, though, I think, you know, to put it in a larger context, I mean, there is part of, again, what he's done, he's renounced a lot of the regalia of the mm-hmm. papacy. And this is part of a longer shift, especially since the 50s and 60s and the reforms of the Pope as a pastor and as a minister. I mean, you had over 2,000 years, you're going to have a lot of iterations. I mean, the church is in culture, in the culture that, you know, it goes along, that it's embedded in, that the church is embedded in. And, you know, you had the rise of the monarchical papacy in the Middle Ages, because that's the form of government that was out there. And so you had that. And of course that was, whether that was wrong in the beginning, but it certainly went to excess. There's no doubt about that. And you've seen this kind of pivoting away from that monarchical view very much to more of a, again, you don't even have, when a Pope becomes Pope, they used to crown him with the tiara, you know,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and the whole thing, and it would start the reign of a Pope. They don't use that language anymore. It's the beginning of the ministry of a Pope, and they're not crowned. The tiara they got rid of. And Pope Francis is very much continuing in the visible way, but also in his interactions to make the Pope more of, frankly, what I think it should be and what it has historically been, is more of a role of pastor and as they say, servant of God.
More of a shepherd than a king.
Exactly.
All right, this is a bit of a longer question, so give me a little grace here while I try to roll through. You know, is to, obviously, Francis is a Jesuit, and there's, I read that there's something called the Black Pope, which is the Superior General of the Society of Jesus, the Father General. Right now, it's my understanding, it's Arturo Sosa. And, you know, since Francis is a Jesuit, it is said that he is under the authority of the Superior General, the Black Pope, that Francis is not the head of the church. He, as a Jesuit, he's under the authority of the Superior General Arturo Sosa. And it is said that the Superior General, this Black Pope, controls Pope Francis, the Vatican, the Illuminati, the Zionists, the Freemasons, the Knights Templar, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, MI6, and other intelligence agencies around the world. They have infiltrated most governments and leaders, including the American presidency.
I wish. We could use it. No, yeah, I think if you look out there today, I wish it were the case. It's hilarious. That's, you know, even Dan Brown might be embarrassed to go. It's, you know, look, again, the Jesuits spawn, they're almost like the Freemasons of the church. They spawn all kinds of conspiracy theories. To answer specifically your question, I mean, it's funny, the head of the Jesuits is called the Black Pope, as opposed to the Pope who dresses in white, in part because the Jesuits, for those who don't know these things, the Society of Jesus grew up, St. Ignatius Loyola, in the decades after the Protestant Reformation, in a series of reform. It wasn't counter-reformation, but it's almost part of the Catholic reform, because the churches always go through periods of corruption and scandal, and we always need to be purified and reformed. And the Jesuits grew up, and they were known as kind of the great missionaries of the church. But they became so successful, they became the largest order of priests. Again, you know, orders, and you have dioceses, and you have a bishop that heads a geographical diocese around the world. Then you have these orders, like the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the various ones, who are global orders of nuns and priests and brothers who teach and do missionary work around the world. And the Jesuits are the largest. And they also run universities for the most part, and makes them very influential. So there's always been this kind of, you know, the Pope's always looking over his shoulder across the street from the Vatican at the Jesuit headquarters and thinking, you know, worrying about them, the Jesuits. And so they call the head of the Jesuits the Black Pope, also because the head of the Jesuits wears a simple black cassock, nothing else. So you've got this visual contrast between the Black Pope and the White Pope. And everyone's so afraid of the Jesuits, of their power in the church, even though their power is at the service of the poor and is educating, that a Jesuit would never become Pope. So what happened? We elected the first Jesuit Pope when we elected Pope Francis. And it's again, this whole idea that the Black Pope controls the White Pope Francis,
yes,
is hilarious.
It's hilarious. Okay.
But it's also, it doesn't make sense, because one thing in particular about Jesuits is they don't only take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to the church, but also they take a fourth special vow of obedience in mission to the Pope himself. So Arturo Sosa, the head of the Jesuits, actually has a special vow of obedience to whoever the Pope is. In other words, the Pope will say, we need you to go here in mission. We need people to go here. The Jesuits up and go. They go to Japan. They have history of martyrs to North America, to Canada, to so many places. And so that's what, so Sosa, it's actually the reverse. Sosa is you know, he's obedient to the Pope.
Back in history, you were mentioning Ignatius of Loyola, 1491, I think he was born. I think the Jesuits were originally a military order. It's my understanding they eventually controlled the Central European Bank. And if I have this right, they were associated with the Khazar Jews and then the Ashkenazi Jews, and that the Jesuits and the Ashkenazi are the same entity.
Jim, that's brilliant. I've never even heard that one before, and I've heard everything about Jesuits. There's a whole series of Jesuit jokes, which I'll share with you at some point. But never heard that. But again, you know, that's and that also shades into that unfortunate kind of anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic kind of thing, I think, that conflates all of these things, you know, together. The idea that, and again, this kind of all secret, all powerful powers behind there. Again, there is much Dan Brown. You should write it up and make money if we're going to promote them.
But all this stuff is around, you know?
I know. You're right. The thing I was going to say about St. Ignatius and the Jesuits as a military order, in the sense they're not military, but St. Ignatius was a soldier. And again, he was a great conversion story, born of an aristocratic family, went in, you know, noble family, drank and spent money and the whole thing, and joined the military and was wounded in battle. And as he was convalescing, his leg had been shattered. He had a great conversion, and you know, changed his life. But the order he founded, the community he founded, he didn't really intend to found an order, but the community he founded, because the military is what he knew, and it's a very hierarchical kind of a thing, and that's how it's sort of structured. They call the head of the Jesuits the Father General.
Yes.
So that gives you a sense of it, and you know, that's not. That's not the dumbest thing in the world to, if you're going to have something, to have it in a very, you know, clearly ordered and ordained kind of organizational system, especially if in the 16th century, you're going to have a global mission.
All right. Okay. Let me ask you, just the other day, about 2 days ago, I read somewhere that the upside down cross on the Pope's throne, on his chair, is a witchcraft symbol.
That's also another good one. I don't think he had, I don't know that he has an upside down cross. I don't know what, I'd have to see a picture, but no and no. The, I don't know that symbol, but I'm not sure. That sounds more satanic than witchcraft. But
I saw a picture online, but I didn't make a copy of it to show you on the camera.
I'll Google it later, but no. And again, witchcraft is one of those things that they would be, they're, you know, just, again, like we said before, they're very much the Vatican, the Catholic Church is very much in dialogue and welcoming of other religions, especially the Abrahamic religions with which we have so much in common, but other things, you know, explicitly demonic things or cultish kind of things, they're totally against because of what they are, but also because of what they do to the human person, you know, how they lead people right. astray and how they, you know, how they can destroy people's lives as well as their souls. And so it's a real, that's something they've always been dead set against.
All right. I know your time is limited, David, so I'll try to keep moving this along.
Sure.
It is said that the Vatican has been trying to get control of Jerusalem for years, and that Pope Francis has established himself as an enemy of Israel, and he wants to divide it up. That he wants to grant diplomatic recognition to the state of Palestine, that he rejected the U.S. move of the capital of Israel to Jerusalem, and that he's an enemy of Israel and wants to divide up Israel.
Let me tease out some of those things. Yeah, he's not an enemy of Israel. Vatican, because again, you know, we've got these terms, and there's the Vatican City State, which is actually its own. You know, there's a sort of geographical, political. It's 108 acres, but it has a international status, like
right.
Monaco or something like that. You know, like and
right.
So yeah, and it is one of those ironic touches. So it has diplomatic relations with, I think, 190 countries around the world, including Israel. It's recognized the state of Israel, accepts the state of Israel. By the way, one of the last countries that the Vatican, the Holy See, as it should be called technically, established diplomatic relations with was the United States back in 1984. And it was Ronald Reagan who insisted on doing that in spite of some grave misgivings by some Protestant allies they didn't think the U.S. should have a relationship like that with the Vatican, with the Holy See. But it was a bit of a Nixon goes to China move. But the vis-a-vis Israel, yeah, they support it. But they also do support Palestinian Authority. They haven't issued any particular, political plan for it. They do want Jerusalem to be an internationally run city because it's sacred, not just to Jews, but also to Christians and Muslims. And there is great concern for, and again, they're seen as, they are critical often of Israel, because obviously there are so many, the Christians are in Palestine and among the Palestinians and in the Arab countries and in Israel are subject to really difficult situations. And so they want to speak up on behalf of our brothers and sisters in the Arab world who are there, as you know. And so they're seen as much more, much like a lot of European states, as much more sympathetic to the Palestinians, and which, leads some to say that they would be enemies and opponents of Israel. But that's not true.
All right. Let me trace back to something I had said earlier about the cabal and the theories about the cabal. It is said that Nancy Pelosi, who is a representative from California, and her father were with the Pope back before the JFK assassination. That may have been John the 23rd or Paul the 6th that would have been back there. And that that the Pope is active in the American political system as part of this grab for power with some of the world's elite, like Bill Gates and George Soros and Pope Francis and the Nancy Pelosi and the governor of California, Gavin Newsom. And do you know anything about their relationship or the relationship of the Pope with the American political machine?
I don't. I'd say none of that is really true. If only it were. A couple of things with this Pope, particularly. Nancy Pelosi was over there for the inauguration of Benedict as Pope in 2005, following the death of John Paul. I ran into her by accident in a Vatican gift shop back then in April 2005. It was kind of funny. I didn't recognize her at first. And but she was very congenial. But there's no relationship between certainly Pope Francis and American political leaders like that at all. If anything, the closest alliance between American political leaders and a Pope was between John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, as they were kind of seen as allies in the fight against Soviet communism. So really that, if anything, was the closest sort of alliance. And, just the idea that would happen is absurd because American Catholics are, as divided as anybody. I mean, that's a whole issue of politics and religion and Catholics in America, which is another discussion. But it's, it used to be back in the JFK days, Catholics were Democrats. Now they're just completely divided. And as they say, there's no Catholic vote, but it's important because it's such a swing vote that whichever way Catholics go, especially in key states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, the upper Midwest, they tend to go with the popular vote because where they're leaning tends to be where the larger populace is leaning. So no, there's no connection like that. Also, just the last point, vis-a-vis John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, who were very close in many respects. Pope Francis is the first Pope not from Europe. He's from Argentina. Right. That's a key thing. He's actually not that interested in the United States. He respects the United States. He loves the United States. His visit here, he gave his addresses here when he visited in September of 2015, I think are really wonderful ones. And his address to Congress, I think, is really worth listening to. And when he talks about politics and bipartisanship and how one should approach that, I think is a wonderful address that I wish we could learn from. Not giving your soul over to politics and being able to work with the other side, for example. But in the global sense, he has a bigger view, you know, and the United States is not front and center for him and his worldview. The vast majority of Catholics, as of all Christians, are in the Southern Hemisphere, in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And he's more concerned, I think, with issues concerning them than he is with our own navel gazing here in the United States.
I have two more questions for you, if you have time for me. They're biggies. Yeah, they're biggies. But let me squeeze in two more, David, and then
good. We got it.
Okay. This one is, I have an article, and of course that makes it true. I have an article that says the grand global merger of all black magic forces occurred when Pope Paul VI became the Pope in 1963, that there was a junction of Luciferianism and Catholicism, and that the black magic Illuminati took over the Vatican in 1963. The assassination of JFK was their first major global strike. And this is all written down in books by Malachi Martin, The Windswept House and The Keys of This Blood. And there was a book called In Face to Face with the Devil. Archbishop Emmanuel Malingo speaks of Satanists that are still at work in the Vatican. And Malingo claims that Pope Paul VI said that the smoke of Satan had entered the Vatican. Now that's a lot of things I've sort of thrown around there. What do you know about any of this?
Yeah, I can say definitely fact check, no, not true. But it's, and again, those are really fringe figures. Archbishop Malingo, I knew a bit when they sort of brought him to the Vatican because he was so off the rails. I think he joined the Unification Church briefly and got married and the whole thing, and very unfortunate, but he was a very nice man, but just kind of off the rails, as I say. Malachi Martin, former Jesuit, so that's where a Jesuit education will get you, just became a kind of rabid conspiracy theorist and wrote a lot of those things. And again, a lot of that goes back, none of that's true and it's silly, but a lot of that goes back to, again, the timing, 1963, you say, you know, the Vatican had a great, when the global Catholic Church feels it needs to talk about things like the Council of Jerusalem, Peter and Paul and the original apostles, they call a council and all the bishops, all the leaders, we believe that the successors of the apostles come to Rome and they talk about things they should do or reforms they should make. And the in the 1960s, 1962 to 1965, they had a three-year meeting called the Second Vatican Council. And that's so many of the people who are kind of conspiracy theorist oppositionists trace their opposition to the Second Vatican Council of the 1960s. So that's when you'll see a lot of this stuff dated to. And they tend to wrap in things like the Kennedy assassination, the nuclear threat was obviously, the Cuban Missile Crisis was obviously very immediate. So you'll see a lot of things that are brought in, and black magic and anti-Semitism, things like that, that are all kind of wrapped into this fevered imagination.
All right. Thanks. Now, my last question for you is maybe the biggest, but we'll see. You know, there is a widespread theory of a child human sex trafficking ring that is run by the United Nations, the Vatican, people in the cabal such as Jeffrey Epstein, the Clintons, Bill Gates, and others. Hmm. It's a satanic pedophilia ring, and lots of priests are in on it. And tapping back to the last question, that the Vatican is where many royal satanic bloodline families go to be initiated into Luciferian royalty, and there are child sacrifices, BBC reported in February 2019 that Pope Francis admitted that the clerical abuse of nuns included sexual slavery. So we've got this huge sexual trafficking, child trafficking, pedophilia ring, and the Vatican is part of the cabal that is not only orchestrating it, but then financially benefiting from it as well. That's just, so, I assume you've heard this, but it's a huge part of the undertow of on the social media.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, you hear various iterations. That's the most kind of Baroque version I've heard. It sounds like the Slytherin house in Harry Potter on steroids, you know. And again, it's no, that's not the case at all. And yet, I think the which pains me because I've covered the sex abuse crisis very much for so long, and the Catholic Church has done a lot, but not enough to clean it up, and it's, you know, it's endemic in so many other churches as well. But the you know, when there's those realities of clergy sex abuse, and again, there's exploitation of women by priests, which is, and nuns, which is what Pope Francis was talking about, which we see again in all of the churches, really coming out in a lot of the Me Too movement here in the United States. But, you know, it's bad enough, horrifying enough, what has happened, again, in the Catholic Church, we just stick to that, with abuse over the years, without having to make it into some satanic kind of overwrought conspiracy. It's not, but the evil that does happen or has happened is bad enough. And I think there's, you know, it's unfortunate to me when we try and elaborate or, you know, on these things to make it even more than it is, because it need not be that. You need to address the evil of abuse within our communities for what it is, without trying to bring in a lot Jeffrey Epstein and all this other kind of stuff and the United Nations. That becomes diversionary to my mind, to the act of protecting children or women or vulnerable people, and can divert us from the important work of atoning for this and recognizing it and protecting people.
Thanks. You know, I told you I wouldn't keep you too long. I appreciate that, David.
No, not at all. It's been it's a good chat. People are going to say, look, that's what he has to say. If problem is too many people,
I mean, he's just covering up for
exactly. Yeah. So people are going to say, oh, well, he's got to say that. And I understand that. But hopefully, you know, I give some explanations about what's behind it and with a understanding where it comes from. And then everyone look. You know, try everything, discern what is good, as they say, St. Paul said. Right. So you have to go, that's the first fact-checking advice that was ever given for Christians. And you have to go out there and you have to check these things out for yourself.
Thanks. Is there anything else you'd like to close off with? I appreciate your time. I really do. I know you're a busy person.
No. I appreciate the conversation. It's good to air these things out and get more light than darkness out there. So hopefully we've done that. And I really appreciate talking to you.
Thanks, David. We'll talk to you later.
For more information, please visit the website at www.thethirdchoice.org. And I invite you to go to the Q&A forum for more information and dialogue. Thanks for tuning in today.